I was probably the ringleader since I was like the one who spent the most time online.
Right.
And it was always really easy for me to find other people's information.
Remember the late 90s, early 2000s? Back when social activity on the internet was instant messaging with your friends, unobserved by parental figures. Back then, nearly 90% of the people who are using the web now didn't even own a personal computer or hadn't even been born yet. Sally, we're not using her real name for reasons that will soon become obvious, was one of that early 10% who was online, one of those early pioneers of the social web. She sat down with Radio Berkman producer Elizabeth Gillis.
I was just curious about him.
Sally's referring to her junior high school gym teacher, who at the time of this story was probably in his late 20s. Today, Sally is about the same age he was.
And we all used AIM, but he used MSN Messenger, it turned out. So,
how did you know it was him? How did you know it was your teacher?
His username was his screen name.
Okay.
People were not as aware of like the footprint that they left.
Right.
Sally says she and her friends were always a little creeped out by this teacher. He showed favoritism towards girls and was a little flirtatious.
I think we wanted to find out, oh, he's really creepy. He's hitting on girls. Is he married? Does he have a girlfriend? Like, what's his deal? How old is he? So we created a fake screen name to talk to him. And
do you remember what the screen name was?
It was KittyBaby417. 417 was because my best friend lived on 417.
Right.
And we're like, Kitty Baby. That sounds provocative. What do we know? We're like 12 or 13.
And so what was your like alter ego? What was the person that you were being when you were?
So we had the screen name and then we're like, oh no, like if we want to talk to him, we can't be us. Like we have to have something. So we created her name. Her name was Eliza McDougal. She was 15 or 16, because that seemed really grown up. Like, you're in high school, you're like your own person. 15 or 16. She's like mature.
Did you realize how creepy it was at the time, or did you feel like that was so much older than you?
We did feel like it was so much older than us. Right. Like, they have boobs. Like,
right.
Like, they are basically an adult. So, no, it didn't seem as creepy as it does now when I'm talking about it. He started talking back to us over the course of not just one night, but many evenings. Like we probably talked to him on and off for 2 or 3 months.
Right. Oh, wow. That's a really long time.
It was a really long time. But it was getting to the point that he'd message us if we were on, too.
Now, in case you're wondering, we're perfectly aware of just how creepy this sounds. In the age of To Catch a Predator and catfishing, the idea of a male gym teacher chatting with a 16-year-old girl who is actually a group of 12-year-old girls sets off all kinds of alarm bells. But Sally says this prank actually felt pretty innocent at the time.
So, like, what did you talk about?
We wanted to know more about him, generally.
Did you ever see him in person during it?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, all the, like, what, when you're gym, like, twice a week? Yeah, we would see him.
Yeah. Did you tell anybody else who was, like, in your gym class?
No, just my friend group, so maybe 4 or 5 girls. But they probably told other people.
Mm-hmm.
This is different. Like, now I would have been, like, that would have gotten out. Someone's mom would have heard about it being cyberbullying and, like, it would have been a thing. Like, notes would have been sent home to the parents. Like,
right.
That people just weren't aware that this could even happen. There was no prohibition on teachers on social media because there was no real social media. Yeah. Like, so we lived on AIM. Like, we would get home from school and just sit on AIM for 6 hours. Like, so MSN Messenger was like a real blank slate for us. Like, it was a client that I could open up and I had no other information on. Like, it was really easy to, I think, become a different person on there because it was a different platform. Yeah, none of that stuff was linked now. Like you know, but you could just spin up a one-time identity, and that was what people thought the web was. Like,
right, you can make up a person.
Mm-hmm. We did. We made up a person.
I guess I think it's interesting then because you are saying how gross and how sleazy, and like now when you think of like somebody pretending to be a 15-year-old girl online, you think of like a police officer.
Yeah, like,
and it's funny because you're using the term cyberbullying, but like
I feel like we were bullying him though.
Right.
But that's how we felt at the time because we didn't really realize how gross it is now.
Right.
But yeah, this was like To Catch a Predator style entrapment. I don't think we were totally aware of that, but totally.
Right. And do you think it's just for you guys, it's that because you don't have any agency outside of your anonymous character?
That sounds appropriate.
Right.
It was, we had power mm-hmm. over a big bad adult.
It was so easy in the early 2000s to be whoever you wanted to be online. For one, social media services simply asked less of you. Also, people were simply less jaded, less suspicious that people were trying to lead them on. As the web has grown up, norms and technologies have come along to verify identities, to track IP addresses, and to prevent other people from misusing your own personal information. But there are plenty of new ways today to spin up fake identities online, and there's so many reasons people do it, both good and bad. On this episode of Radio Berkman, we talked to several folks who have experience with digital alter egos. We also collected some voicemails from you, our audience, to tell us why and when you have hid your identity online. Oh, and in case you're wondering how the saga of Kitty Baby 417 ends, I'll tell you. As with most things, it actually ended way less dramatically than you'd expect. The gym teacher's fiance found out about their chat. She sent Eliza, aka Kitty Baby 417, aka Sally, and her junior high school friends a long message, the gist of which was, "Stay away from my man." The girls never logged into MSN Messenger again. No one ever found out who they really were.
This is Tiffany. My digital alter ego persona story is when I was growing up, I would design websites just for fun, and I was part of this web design community. But since we were all around like 13 to 16 years old, and around that time, it was a big taboo to use your name online. We would all just have our own separate alias names. And so it was kind of an accepted norm that everyone online wasn't reusing their real name, and when you made emails, you would have an email separate for the community that uses that alias because that's how you communicated. So yeah, that's my story.
I mean, the way I've been thinking about it is not so much an intentional alter ego, but the alter ego that is the combination of all the things that you've done online, right? All your clicks, all your behaviors, all your kind of personal data profile that is supposed to be a representation of you, but like in a lot of other ways acts as this alter ego on your behalf, right? And so I've been calling it the data doppelganger.
You have your Twitter profile, your Facebook profile, your LinkedIn, your Google, your Netflix, your Tumblr, Instagram, Snapchat, Slack, Yelp, Spotify, Pinterest, all these different ways of interacting online. And each service is its own distinct thing, its own little world that describes one part of your personality. Sarah Watson says these distinct worlds can actually amalgamate. They can actually come together to represent a whole you.
Your alter ego on Pinterest is like super girly, or, you know, really obsessed with weddings, or just like really loves manicures. Or, you know, your alter ego on 4chan, like what is that like? And so you have all these kind of disparate alter egos of your kind of personal context in any given location.
But Sarah has noticed that companies are trending towards trying to unite their services, trying to unite data streams so they can learn as much as they possibly can about you. And the scary thing is, even if you're not using these services, the services can still be learning about you.
If I've created a Twitter account to start trolling or sock puppeting or whatever, even if you have gone to great lengths to use ways of masking your email and all these other things, like the way that Twitter's designed is to give, you know, network effect. And so whatever data they can pull to kind of understand your contact list and your phone number and whatever else is, you know, up for grabs. Another good example of this is my husband just the other day was saying, so Facebook's asking me to confirm what my phone number is, and it's the right phone number. Like, where I've never ever given Facebook my phone number. How did this happen? Yeah. And we can kind of speculate a number of ways that that might have happened. For one, I have given Facebook my access to my contact list. So, like, that's the direct answer, right? Like, once I have populated my Apple phone with all the Facebook data from my friends, you know, fill in the blanks and, you know, do some mixing and matching of the data sources, that is a two-way flow, and then you have, you know, a matched phone number. And that, like, it takes just me to do that probably, but, you know, consider all the other friends who have also done the same.
So there's not only like this digital doppelganger that is the quantity of data that you yourself have contributed to your digital corpus. It's like everything about you that anybody else has contributed.
Absolutely. And I think that's so hard to control and so hard to know that when you're clicking, like, yes, access my contact list, that has, you know, a secondary and tertiary effect for everyone else who's in your contacts.
Okay, so on the surface, this seems creepy. Like, I obviously, like, very Big Brother-like, and, you know, beyond that, like, why, in your mind, is this something to be aware of?
I mean, I think these are the ways that the systems are designed, right? Like, it's to understand its impacts on your life, you have to start to understand how the motivations and the kind of business processes and the default settings and the kind of ways the companies want these things to work. And you can't just, you know, pretend like it's just there for you to use. They also have an interest in mind. And in this case, in this particular case of, you know, Facebook understanding your phone number, is that they want to build the network as much as they possibly can.
Well, why might it be important for us to be able to have a space online or a way online to engage anonymously or create an alternate identity that we can be fully confident is disaggregated from our real human personality and identification?
We've always had ways of trying things out as human beings to develop our sense of self and develop our sense of community and what experimentation of, like, what works for us and what doesn't. And that's a constant negotiation. And I think, you know, everyone always points to, like, this stuff lives forever once it's online. I think there's more to be said about the kind of network effects of being able to have a testbed that is somewhat guaranteed to not kind of bleed over into other spaces until you decide that you want it to.
Sarah Watson is a technology critic and a research fellow at the Tau Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University.
Hi, I wanted to share a story. It's not particularly of me, it's of my little sister. She's 16, and she's in the product of divorce in a way that the older siblings my age and a few years younger haven't been. And we recently found that she had an anonymous Tumblr site. She didn't want when I asked her about it, she said she didn't want anyone from school to know it. She didn't want anyone in our family to know about it. It was just her place where she went to vent about all the negative things going on between our parents fighting and how she was feeling about it and feeling alone. And she said it felt good to get it out, but it was easier for her than talking to it about or talking to friends about it at school or talking to us about it. She felt like it was just a place where she can get out her emotions and move on with her life. And I just think it's something really interesting and wonder what the effects of that are going to be long term, just outsourcing our emotions instead of talking with actual people about it who can share their experiences and offer support. I know she feels some sense of support online when people like her posts or reblog them, but I'm just wondering what kind of long-term this effect this is going to have emotionally.
So when I started really getting into Twitter, I think 2012, 2013, there was, and I know this is like an outdated term and it's like kind of controversial to say it, but it was like, quote, weird Twitter. It was a really kind of like niche underground comedy thing on Twitter. And I was just one of those people who like had a Twitter account because you were supposed to, but I had no idea what to do with it. It was a picture of like my real life face and I was like Jonathan's son. I noticed that this kind of group of weird Twitterers, they were all anonymous. I remember the moment actually when I drew that alien face of Jomny, and it was just a placeholder. I have always wanted to replace it, and I never got around to changing it, but now it's become so much part of my identity that it's just stuck.
Jonathan's son is the man behind the Twitter account, Jomny's Son. Johnny, spelled J-O-N-M-Y, like as if someone spelled Johnny wrong. And that's kind of the point of Jomny. His bio reads, alien confused about human language. And all the words are spelled wrong. His location, planet Earth.
It's more of that viewpoint of an outsider or someone who is kind of looking at the world in like a naively positive way.
I'd like to note here that we're not outing Jomny. The account was always anonymous, but with over 120,000 people following him on Twitter, his secret identity has been harder to keep secret. Now you can pretty easily find out the Jomny behind the Jomny. Jomny's tweets are hard to describe, like they're hilarious. I want to read them to you, but they actually only kind of sound funny if you read them in your head.
First rule of Fight Club is no fighting. Welcome to Contradiction Club. Everyone have a seat and don't have a seat. Also, this...
Okay. We'll give some of them a try. This one's from 2013.
First rule of Fight Club is no fighting. Welcome to Contradiction Club. Everyone have a seat. I can't read that one.
The first rule of Fight Club is no fighting. Welcome to Contradiction Club. Everyone have a seat and don't have a seat. Also, this isn't Contradiction Club.
Who could read these?
But some of them are a little more thoughtful and even sweet, like this one also from 2013.
Look, life is bad. Everyone's sad. We're all going to die. But I already bought this inflatable bouncy castle, so are you going to take your shoes off or what?
That tweet you just heard has been shared close to 20,000 times and favorited by nearly 30,000 people, which, if you don't quite know Twitter statistics, basically means it made a strong impression. Folks like Kanye West and President Obama get those same kind of numbers on every tweet they make. But Jomny is quick to downplay his own popularity and notes that there are a lot of accounts like his on Twitter. There's some combination of jokes and insights hidden behind this kind of semi-anonymous character.
Was it important to you as like a real human being to kind of keep that line separate just artistically or also kind of just for your own self-preservation? Or
definitely both. For me, it's very therapeutic, and it's a nice thing to have this place that I can put unfiltered thoughts or just emotions or ideas or whatever just out into the void. It's very freeing, and I think it's nice. It's helped me, I think, grow as a person in real life as well.
But why is it important? Why couldn't you just be Jonathan's son, person who makes funny comments?
I think when you have those two that are, and they're the same, I think when you have like a Twitter account or an online account that is directly related to you, that account has faces like the same social pressures and the same kind of stigmas, I guess, or whatever you want to call it, boundaries that you face as a real person, because everything you say online, if it's connected to who you are, comes back to you.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like if you have this outlet, you can kind of purge in that space a few of the thoughts that you might not want to be, you know, connected to later on.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not like controversial stuff. It's more just like, I feel really lonely today, or like some expression of that, which you can't, as like crazy as it is, you can't say that in real life. It's just not something that people react well to, you know? But if you put it online and you disconnect it from one of your friends finding out you say that, there's just a way of being more honest and being more vulnerable online if you have some sort of anonymity associated with it. You don't face the same kind of social scrutiny in the same way from people you know in real life.
Yeah, you're not going to get a call from your, you know, your cousin or your grandmother or something. It's like, I saw that you were lonely.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm so worried about you.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's just this different attitude on Twitter towards that stuff than there is in real life, which I think is really nice.
I almost hadn't thought about that, like the importance of that anonymity as a therapeutic, you know, mechanism.
It's like, I think it's why people used to diary a lot. And like write down their thoughts somewhere where people wouldn't see it, right? Mm-hmm. I think there's that same kind of mechanism, except now instead of in a diary that no one sees, it's out into the void, which is still disconnected from yourself in real life, you know?
Yeah. I'm curious at what points, maybe it was multiple points for you, that you kind of like realized that this persona that you had was starting to like get to a certain level. You are sometimes shouting into the void, but sometimes you reach a certain number of followers and like
it shifts,
right?
Yeah. It shifts from becoming like this entirely personal, anonymous thing to like something that now you have like a soapbox to stand on, or you have a voice that will be heard.
Yeah.
The strangest aspect of that shift is that you kind of lose your friends on Twitter. Once I think your account becomes big enough that it's seen as someone who produces content instead of just a person who's talking, I found like the people that I used to be super close with just like by joking around and just kind of messing around, that kind of disappears in a way, because they also, I think, see the shift. I will say about anonymity in general is that there's a theory of technology where technology is neither like inherently good or bad. It's just, especially communications technology, it's just a medium. It's a catalyst for increasing the way people would interact and communicate already. It's just expanding and magnifying those types of communications. So because of that, you get really good stuff through Twitter and anonymity, and you also get really bad stuff. And it's just human nature and the nature of communication. It's just that stuff is magnified through Twitter and technology. So for every like good thing that comes out of being anonymous, you also get all these really negative things. Like there are a lot of problems on Twitter with abuse and with hate speech and just like that incredibly dark side of human communication, I guess, of society, where now that you're freed from your online persona, you're freed from the responsibility of being like a good person almost, which is incredibly frustrating to see. But you see all these anonymous accounts where it's just someone who realized, oh, I can like say whatever the hell I want on Twitter and like say all this hateful speech and all this abuse and it will never get linked back to me. So that stuff is also like, that's the horrible side.
Yeah. Can I ask if you've ever been the recipient of that kind of thing?
Yeah, definitely. A lot actually, but I feel like I can never complain because I know the amount of kind of stuff I get is nothing, like absolutely nothing compared to, just any woman on Twitter, any openly queer account on Twitter. And so I'm incredibly fortunate in that way where I feel like I don't get it. And I know that when I see the stuff that gets said about me like once a day, I'm like, I can see that and it makes me feel really horrible. But I'm like, if this happens to people every second that they're online, right? Yeah. And that like that kind of abuse, for some people, it never stops.
Well, you also have the like fortunate aspect of your Twitter personality is that it's separate from you. So you can almost say, if you do receive abuse, it's like, oh, they're mad at this character. They're not necessarily mad at me.
Yeah, that's true. Except I think the connection, I don't think that disconnect is entirely there for me. But yeah, the idea of like switching identity, I think, is really interesting, especially when like there are a lot of joke accounts like Coffee Dad, who like the whole persona and like viewpoint and identity is the joke. Like, you know Coffee Dad, right? And so like
you should describe it though.
I'll describe it. Coffee Dad's basically just this character that is a dad who likes coffee, and every tweet he does is something about loving coffee, and that's it, right? I think
basically. Yeah. And it's like a stock photo of a dad.
Yeah, and it's like, it's just, that's it, that's the entire account, but it's been going on forever, and it's always just like, I love coffee, or like, damn, the smell of coffee in the morning. And that's it. But it's gone on for so long that commitment is, I think it's fascinating. And like people like that account because that's like the long form joke, right?
Well, I guess the other question in the anonymity thing I wanted to ask was how people in real life that you have known for years, who know you outside of the character and have mm-hmm. known you before the character, how they have reacted to learning about this aspect of your life.
Yeah, that's the most embarrassing thing. I'm happy with like people online, like meeting people that I know through Twitter in real life and like going in that direction. But for some reason, I get so like flustered and embarrassed when people I know in real life follow me on Twitter. Or like the worst is when someone reads your tweets in front of you. Or like if they ask like, oh, what's your Twitter account? I'm like, I'm at Johnny Sun. And they pull out their phone and they start reading. And I think the reason for that is that maybe online there's like some sort of honesty or this emotional vulnerability that you can put onto Twitter and online that you can't really do in real life. Or you can experiment and like with different ideas on Twitter that you can't do in real life. And so like when someone you know in real life that you've cultivated like a relationship based on like your real life identity sees your other identity, that's like a bit strange. But when someone sees your like online identity and meets you in person, I feel like that's different, because if you've been able to relate with them online through like these abstracted, maybe more honest personas, then in real life it's easier.
Yeah, it doesn't you don't have to reconcile, yeah, like in a way as much. If they know this kind of weird aspect of you, then it's like, oh, we've already crossed that bridge.
Exactly. It's definitely the weird part of you. Like, yeah, you don't really want everyone you know to know like the weird parts of you. Right?
Jonathan Sun is a PhD candidate at MIT. Johnny Sun is an alien confused by human language on Twitter.
Hi, this is Christian Sandvig. I'm a computer researcher, and I'm calling because I guess I have a lot of digital alter egos. I do research where I try to investigate online platforms to see if they treat everyone who uses them fairly. So one way to do that is to make a bunch of accounts on a platform, which are sometimes called sock puppets, and then have these accounts do different things to see if they get the same or different results. For example, why do people on some platforms get different prices than other people? Or why are people shown some real estate listings but not other real estate listings? However, that also involves making fake accounts and lying. So another way that I have a digital alter ego is that I sometimes pay people to browse the web for me. So I use Mechanical Turk, and I ask people from all around the world, especially different kinds of people, to look at the same website, and I check to see if they see the same thing or something different. So I guess, so that's my digital alter ego.
The genesis of the thing is that the niqab became an issue in the recent Canadian election campaign. Basically, there was a woman who wanted to take the citizenship oath in Canada, and she wanted to attend the ceremony wearing the niqab. And the government at that time made a political issue out of it and proposed banning people from wearing the niqab in government offices.
Vivek Krishnamurthy is a clinical instructor at Harvard Law School's Cyber Law Clinic. He's also from Canada. During the last Canadian election, he created a Tumblr in response to the politicizing of the veil sometimes worn by Muslim women.
Niqabs of Do Canada is just a bunch of photos of people in Canada who are wearing apparel that bears an uncanny resemblance to the most conservative form of Muslim head covering. So this is a collection of pictures of people in Canada who are bundled up against winter cold in such a way that, you know, all you could see is their eyes as well. It was a piece of protest, it was a piece of satire, it was a piece of commentary that, you know, especially in Canada where it's cold for 9 months of the year. The fact of the matter is that for purely functional reasons, we have to cover our faces and we interact in the public sphere covered because we're cold. So what is the big deal around this, right? That was sort of like the idea behind the whole Tumblr. If you look at the first mention of that URL on Twitter or Facebook, you know, it's me. So again, I didn't feel like I needed to hide that fact, but I also didn't feel that I had to sign my name to it and make it about me. Because it wasn't, as even to this day, I don't think it's about me. It's really about the issue, and it's a piece of commentary about the ridiculousness of that particular issue in the context of the election.
It wasn't impossible to tie the site back to Vivek, but at the time, nobody really did. In the middle of a pretty contentious election between conservatives and progressives in Canada, Vivek's blog had struck a chord. It got shared on the CBC, on Huffington Post, on Vice. It didn't really matter who was behind it. Even though Vivek is a lawyer with a pretty high profile, he never really worried about this potentially controversial blog being traced back to him.
Yeah. I mean, again, I myself think that, you know, if my circumstances were different, I may have chosen to be more anonymous about what I said.
He says anonymity can be incredibly important to preserving free speech online. But just like free speech, he says, anonymity should have limits.
I think the problem is when you couple anonymity with things that are socially problematic, mm-hmm. right? You know, so...
Examples.
If you think about, you know, revenge porn, right, is a great example of this.
Yeah. Are there ways of classifying that kind of speech as not speech? Because when I think of speech, when people think about freedom of speech, they right. are thinking about really good things. Like.
Yeah.
That it's really important for someone to be able to speak. But like when you bring in words like revenge porn or like bomb threat or like things like fire in a crowded theater, that gets, I wonder if there's like another word we can use for that kind of speech.
Yeah, so it's interesting because, and you know, different legal systems have different ways of dealing with this. In the American system, right? There's a moment, there's a line between speech and a speech act and an act, right? There's like kind of a continuum, right? So... JFK speaking clearly in the core of speech, right? Then there are, in the middle, speech acts, right? Like the thing about shouting fire in a crowded theater, it's not pure expression per se, right? It's expression that causes a very particular reaction that we view as highly dangerous. So in the US, we sort of categorize some things as protected speech, or unprotected speech. Most other Western democracies take a different view, which is they say, okay, pretty much everything that could be characterized as expression is speech. Then they consider, can we justify restricting that in a democratic society, right? So they'll concede that revenge porn is in fact speech, but say that, yeah, it's justified to restrict that because of the detrimental effect on others.
I mean, fire in a crowded theater is like the classic case
yeah.
of like knowing what you say will cause an action.
Right.
But then, so how does that iterate across different examples? There's the example of, like there was in Texas, they had a competition to draw pictures of the Prophet Muhammad. And like in their own way, this community was like making a statement that, you know, they won't tolerate having their freedom of speech oppressed, but it also was an incitement as well in a way, or is just deemed an incitement by other communities in the area?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, at least most legal systems, you know, most democratic legal systems sort of look at this imminence thing. Like, how long is the causal chain between what you say or what you express and the bad act, right? I mean, there are democracies such as India that criminalize blasphemy, right? They just say this entire category of speech that they define as insulting religious sentiments or other vague, you know, turns of phrase are just out, right? They just don't get protection. Yeah, I think that's what does sort of the work in most democracies. It's like how far away is the harm? But of course, other democracies are perfectly happy to ban entire categories of speech, right? Take anything that glorifies the Nazis, right? That's banned in Germany, right? It's protected speech here.
Yeah. When we first started talking about this, I was kind of hoping that your story would have been something where you were like a little more like hidden, but like you say, your Tumblr is like fairly innocuous and it's also really funny. So,
right.
You know, there's nothing to hide.
No, not much to hide, but you know, I'm sympathetic, very sympathetic to those who want to make similar statements or, you know, different statements that feel like they can't do that, you know, with full public exposure, right? So I think we need to preserve that space.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of the continuing challenges of our current existence.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right, awesome. Vivek Krishnamurthy is a clinical instructor at Harvard Law School's Cyber Law Clinic.
When I told my 18-year-old, I was like, I gotta tell you about this catfish thing. And she listened to the whole thing and she's like, y'all are just dumb. You think a 61-year-old grandma is gonna be on the internet telling jokes like this? She's like, y'all fell for that one. And she just walked upstairs.
Oh,
like,
my gosh.
You right.
Kelly is a mother to teenagers. She lives in the American South. I'm sure you can hear her Southern accent. But she also lives on Twitter. Her daughter first told her about Twitter years ago. She made an account, started following some funny people, and posted little jokes and a few, not many, details about her personal life. She eventually racked up more than 20,000 followers on Twitter, and she was becoming kind of well-known within this one little corner of the internet. But this story really starts with the group direct message, the DM. If you don't know Twitter, if you don't know the DM, all you need to know is, basically, Twitter has this little feature where a group of people can carry on a private conversation away from the main public thread. It's like an email chain or a group text message. The group chat was a weird cross-section of Kelly's friends on Twitter. There were young and old folks, parents and single folks. Some were smaller accounts and others were big names with lots of followers. One member of the chat was actually a brand, a legitimate verified corporate Twitter account, who we won't name here.
When we first started, you know, kind of communicating, it was just like friendly, not too into details about each other's personal lives. It was just like kind of just telling jokes and stuff.
The group chat was mostly a lot of inside joking around, but occasionally people would share more personal things, vacation photos, stories about their families, even personal tragedies.
So as far as, you know, Twitter's concerning, you know how it is. Like, there's some big accounts in there, and they're anonymous, and they want to stay anonymous. In that chat, we got to see birthday party pictures, and, you know, we know what they look like, and it was spoken and unspoken that this would not be shared on the timeline. So it was definitely a safe place for that, which is, I guess, kind of weird, but also a weird kind of place to vent about your personal life. You know, you don't have to maybe look them in the eye type thing.
Over time, Kelly became closer friends with these people. Some of them even met up in real life. The DM would lose and add people, but it was this consistent shared private space on what was otherwise a public forum.
And the first person we added was Gretchen, because we just had followed each other for a few years.
Gretchen was in her 60s, which, as far as Twitter goes, is really uncommon. Like Kelly, she was from the South. Her husband had passed away, so she was looking for some kind of social outlet. She became well known on this small corner of Twitter for tweeting sometimes ironic, sometimes crude jokes, which fit in well with the personalities of the DM. Kelly said Gretchen's comments in the DM would alternate between funny and really, really serious.
She really shared a lot. She went into detail about losing her husband and dating, and she really kind of talked about her depression and anxiety. And there were about two times that she told us, I'm sorry, I feel like I'm going to hurt myself.
Sometimes Gretchen would disappear for long periods of time. No one was ever sure if she had hurt herself or if she was just being quiet. Along the way, Kelly and Gretchen formed a stronger friendship and started talking privately, just the two of them.
As far as me personally, Gretchen and I would talk with Side Chat, and we would talk about like relationships or sex or anything we wanted to talk about, because we were like the older woman. I say that. She said she was 61, and I'm 39. It's not like I'm, you know, the crypt keeper or anything, but I just related to her because she was older, I thought, you know, so I felt safe talking to her about things. And she not really influenced me, but I really thought she is a voice of reason. Looking back, it's so manipulative.
If you're familiar with the phenomenon of catfishing, what comes next won't surprise you. Catfishing is basically a con that goes like this. An otherwise ordinary person assumes a false identity on the internet and starts friendships and relationships online. They'll make up a whole other character, sometimes stretching their identity out to multiple social networks using photos and videos they lift from other people's online profiles. The term is based on a documentary from 2010 called Catfish, where a man discovers his online girlfriend is not who she claims to be. Catfishing has become so common that an MTV show called Catfish has run for 5 seasons, 57 whole episodes, about people getting seduced, conned, and duped by people pretending to be other people online. So at this point in the story, Gretchen and Kelly had been friends for about half a year. That's when Gretchen decided to introduce someone new to the DM, her nephew.
And I was nice to him because I thought he was Gretchen's nephew.
Gretchen's nephew was around the same age as Kelly. He was single and didn't live that far away. Gretchen began to suggest that Kelly and the nephew become romantically involved. And then Gretchen began to behave more erratically and unpredictably. She told the group she had fallen in love with someone who lived in England. She had even moved to England to be with them and probably wouldn't be on Twitter anymore. In one of her last DM conversations with Kelly, she said, "My nephew's in love with you. You two should date." But Kelly noticed something odd in a screenshot Gretchen sent her. Her phone was in the same time zone. Gretchen wasn't in England. Gretchen was in Kelly's time zone. This is where everything began to unravel. Kelly did a little detective work. She compared photos that Gretchen had sent her side by side with photos from the nephew and noticed similarities. They owned the same couch. There was the same art on their walls. Kelly talked with people in the group DM about it. They reverse image searched Gretchen's profile photo and discovered the picture was stolen. Finally, they confronted Gretchen. Gretchen and her nephew turned out to be the same person. Or rather, the nephew, a single guy in his late 30s, had completely made up Gretchen, a widowed woman in her 60s.
I mean, like at one point I remember like Gretchen and I exchanging like links to like vibrators, like laughing and like stuff like that. Like, I hate Twitter. Like, you think you're joking around with like a woman that you're, you know, but it's, no, it's a man.
And then things blew up. For a moment, it seemed everyone on Twitter was joking about it.
I can't come to work today because it was a man.
We're bleeping out Gretchen's Twitter handle here.
Damn, I've barely committed to anything in my life for as long as committed to posing online as a crazy woman named Gretchen.
Thinking about how I got all concerned about his depression, but it was actually just a man? LOL, gross.
I'm pissed I fell for it. even if we weren't best friends or anything like that, I mean, I talked to this person, all of us did in the chat, all of us, almost every day for a year. So it's just like that whole shock, mourning, laughing. There's been a lot of jokes. Like, we still, like, in the chat, I'll be like, man, has anyone heard from Gretchen? Like, it's been a while. Like, we just kind of mess with that, you know, like.
This, it sounds like you're feeling like this is another, like, an actual death in a lot of ways. This is, like, losing somebody.
But, no, I mean, I wouldn't say it's, like, I don't consider this, like, a death or anything like that. It's more angry. I'm angry. I'm mad. But I also feel, like, kind of personally, like, targeted in a way, because they were both in my DMs, just at my butt. And not all of us are like that in the chat, you know?
The nephew found ways to continue to reach out to Kelly. Even the day we did this interview, she was still receiving notes. He's tried to explain himself.
He experienced a loss, and he just didn't know how to handle it. And he created a few online personas, he said, and it was wrong. And he knew once he was in the chat and everyone was sharing, and like you said, everyone was vulnerable, he just couldn't keep it up. So he was basically trying to kill her off with her suicide attempts, or have her live with the girlfriend forever. He was going to kill her off or get rid of her. And then he was going to remain with, he wanted to be himself in the chat.
So this is a person who you had gotten to know as Gretchen, and you're seeing her do all of these radical things and like try to extricate herself from your lives. And,
yes.
You know, when you develop that attachment to somebody, that's just something that feels wrong. You don't want to lose this person.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, it's really hard because I get very torn about this because it is just a website and I do have a life.
And is there like a part of you that when you read explanation that identifies with that or understands with it? Or
no.
Where, yeah, what is it?
And it's weird because I am a mama, and I'm tenderhearted, you know, but I think, I don't know, because it came with this deception, I don't care that you lost anyone. I've had bad loss, and I just didn't choose to be a garbage person. Like, it kind of freaks me out when he goes in length with his explanations, because I think you are so psychotic. Like, it, one of the last conversations we had before I busted him out is he was asking me who my favorite serial killer was. And I think about that a lot because I remember having to like look his up. He's a delusional, insane person. I never felt bad for him.
How has this affected you and how you treat Twitter?
I want to be completely done with Twitter. It was a neat release. I started out by like, you know, live tweeting the birth of my fourth child. I'm done. I feel stupid. I feel jaded. I feel angry.
But at the same time, this person had sort of strung a lot of people along with this, not just jokes, but with lots of very personal, made up, but personal details about somebody to make you care about them.
Right. And I saw two women in particular. I don't care if Gretchen wasn't who she said, you know, said she was. One person said, that person was nicer to me than my own father. So I DM'd her. I was like, why are you romanticizing this? He completely got into your life as a 61-year-old woman, and you shared details with her. And yeah, she was nice to you, but it wasn't she. It was him, and he probably had an angle. Her or his deception went well beyond the chat.
It's kind of amazing that, like, the more we talk about it, like, there's still just another kind of an anecdote that, like, just reveals layers. Another layer of, like, how sick this
is. So many layers. Yeah, that's what we were talking about. Like, this is, like, we just call it the long con.
Yeah. We reached out to the man behind the Gretchen account, and he declined to talk. Kelly is still on Twitter. Earlier this year, she started a fresh new account, and we're not telling you what it is.
So I'm here with Elizabeth Gillis, and we're going to talk about anonymity online. I am curious, after hearing these stories, Liz, do you have a position on anonymity? Do you think it's good? Is it bad?
That's a loaded question. There's a lot to that question. I don't think it's inherently good or bad. Anonymity, since it is such a huge part of the online world, even if you're not intentionally trying to be anonymous, if, for example, what Sarah Watson was saying, these alter egos that you have just by interacting with the online world, it's becoming more, even more so, a part of our lives now. And to say that it's either good or bad as something that's so interwoven in our lives, I don't think you can say that, because it's so a part of the human experience these days that I don't think it can be either.
Like the only times it really matters to verify your identity is when there's some sort of transaction. And I mean transaction not just in the financial sense. So in the case of Kelly and Gretchen, you know, they were becoming closer and closer friends. And at some point, like, you know, they want to be exchanging phone numbers so they can talk on the phone together, or like exchanging email addresses. And that's the point at which you want to like kind of verify that this person is who they really are, say they are.
Right.
I mean, I'm super interested in this Gretchen person, like as a person behind the like catfish identity. Like, you want to see how far they can go.
Yeah, like I was so struck by, I remember just the first time I heard that interview, and when she says he tried to extricate himself from the situation, he was trying to kill her off. So he was trying to kill her. And
he was trying to kill off the woman that he'd created, Gretchen.
Yeah. And it was totally his creation. And he had so many options there. And it's interesting to think about the ways in which he was limited, and that he was related to her. So he was going to be somebody that everyone else could talk to if, like, she just went away.
Yeah, and there's so much a part of this woman's personality that is probably him as well. Like, he was depressed and he was going through a lot. And so he infused in this person that he created all of these parts of his personality that he probably felt uncomfortable with in real life. And it's a lot easier when you put up somebody who isn't you, who you can completely disown,
right,
to just like get out and vent these parts of your personality that you're uncomfortable with.
And I think this is interesting because it kind of connects some of the other interviews that we heard, with like Sarah Watson saying we really need to preserve this space where people can explore themselves and explore who they are in a way that feels safe. He is kind of doing that. He might feel safer talking about depression or all these other things that he's self-conscious about as somebody else, and being able to separate himself from this person. Then there's also Vivek's whole thing, where the problem with anonymity is when it becomes socially problematic.
Right.
And it's socially problematic to do that when you're deceiving other people.
Yeah, there's this really dark side where, to that particular story with Kelly, where, you know, Gretchen is not just being a different person online, they're being a different person online and trying to sucker other people into doing things for them. And that is something that we shouldn't have. It shouldn't,
right.
This shouldn't be something that happens commonly. And I don't know what to say about that. I don't know if it's something that we can better engineer out of platforms, or just ask people to be more wary of things.
See, I think it's the second thing. I really think, because the platforms can only do so much. I think this is something that Johnny definitely brought up, that is the technology good or bad, or is it just the people? Because we're putting all the stuff, we're the ones using it, we're the ones interacting on it. Can we fix the platform, or would we have to really fix the humanity behind the platform?
Mm-hmm.
Which is where a lot of the mistakes are made.
Yeah, and you can't engineer out of a platform intention, right? Like,
yeah,
the same thing that makes it possible for someone to anonymously explore dark parts of their personality that help them therapeutically, and the same thing about an anonymity that lets you, you know, be a whistleblower or an activist,
right,
online, trying to engineer out the like devious intent behind anonymity will also squash some of those other things.
But I mean, if we go all the way back to Sally's story.
Yeah, if we go all the way back to Sally's story, I mean, it's interesting along this continuum. Like, Sally was operating on the web at a time when no one was thinking about the
right
potential of being catfished
and
or stalked.
As a really young person.
As a young person.
Who, I mean, how much are we going to hold her accountable as a 12-year-old for knowing when something's socially problematic?
Yeah. And there was no, like, curriculum for digital education or, like, parents at that time didn't know what to do with social networks. They just, right. Social networks weren't even a term back then. We're still having the same problems, but it's more like you should know better, like,
yeah.
At this point. Like, the really, there's enough, changed. There's enough, like, news stories about people being not who they say they were online that.
People are expected to be savvier about talking to people who they don't know. And also, we are recognizing that when people catfish other people, that's not cool. Like, that's just not cool, man. Like, don't do that. I personally think that if Gretchen gets invited into this group chat because Gretchen's really funny. If once Gretchen got into the group chat, he was like, hey, guys, by the way, Gretchen's my... like fake account because it's funny that way. Because it's true. Like, part of the reason Gretchen was funny was because she was a 61-year-old woman.
Sure.
It's fair for somebody to be like, I'm just a funny person, but I know that putting on this, like, that, like, becoming this person online will make me funnier. But, like, this is who I really am.
Yeah.
I think that would have helped him so much because now he can still be funny. He can still maybe crack jokes as Gretchen. But people are at least aware that it's, there's somebody behind that mask. Because, like, right. There were people in that chat who were anonymous accounts who never told anyone who they were, but it was just known that I'm not the person that
right.
I
they
am
never
online.
Said who they really were, but everyone yeah. knew that they didn't say who they really were.
Right. Be upfront with us to the extent that we need you to be to get closer to you.
Gretchen could have been Gretchen and stayed Gretchen just as long as they weren't making up BS.
Right. And then not going into, like, private DMs with people and maintaining that they were that person, even when things started yes. to get more serious or more personal.
So rules for catfishers out there.
Rules for catfishers. We've laid them all out.
Well, thank you very much, Liz. This was a fun episode to do. This was really awesome. My name is Daniel Dennis Jones. You've been listening to Radio Berkman. You can find out more about this episode and all of our guests at cyber.law.harvard.edu on the show notes. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, and Elizabeth Gillis, who did almost all of the editing, and with extra help from Gretchen Weber from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.